He could have been a statue model in Greece or Rome.
The light was so rich that he seemed like a statue now, an otherworldly nature made of light and shade, with a southern accent and a form-fitting shirt. Stevie wasn't sure if the wooziness she felt around him was attraction, or just numb confusion as her brain tried to work out his exact species. "Looks human," it was saying to itself, "but cannot be. Cheekbones not possible. Is simulation, origin unknown." "Together?" she said, pulling herself out of her mental wanderings.
"See, my agent."
He dug a neatly manicured fingernail coyly into the wooden floor as he said this word.
"Thinks I should make another series. I've been thinking about what to do, and I thought, what about the stuff that happened here? The crimes, the kidnapping thing. You know about that."
"About?" Hayes was super distracting to talk to in close quarters, and now he was talking about making a series. None of this made sense.
"The crimes,"
he said again.
"You know about the crimes, right? The crime here? Crimes?"
"Crimes," she repeated. "Yeah, I do, but..." "What?" She was not coming off well.
"You'd be, like, the technical director, the expert. I even had an idea for a trailer. We could shoot it in that tunnel, the one under the sunken garden."
Everything came into sharp focus in a second. "The tunnel?" she said. "You mean the one the kidnappers used?"
"Under the sunken garden," he repeated.
"That tunnel has been filled in since 1938, Stevie said.
"They dug it out in the spring,"
Hayes said, his smile widening.
"For construction. They started at the end of last school year. I've already been in it."
"You were in the tunnel?" Stevie said. She was leaning forward, and she made no effort to hide the urgency in her voice.
"Once,"
he said.
"Last year, when they first excavated it."
The idea of the tunnel being open again had never occurred to Stevie. She really did not believe in fate, but the timing of this was incredible.
"I was just thinking how it would be a good place to make something. And you're here now, and you know all the stuff about the crimes. People would like that. We'd be the first ones to show what the tunnel looks like."
Stevie's heart was pounding hard. "Are we allowed in there?"
"Well..."
Hayes unfurled his smile slowly.
"Technically, we don't know about it. They tried to hide the fact that they opened it up, but I was back there one day and we saw that they were taking out tons of dirt."
"And you actually went in?"
"Actually went in,"
Hayes said.
"But it's just an idea. If you're too busy, I understand."
"I'll do it," Stevie said. "Right, or whatever, I'll do it."
"Great,"
Hayes replied.
"So you'll get Nate, and you guys can write something over the weekend? By Monday?"
"Wait, what?"
"It doesn't have to be long,"
Hayes said.
5 pages or something, 10. Just something about the crime. Something that happens in the tunnel. Didn't some student die? Or the thing with the ransom? Wasn't there a thing with the ransom? With a boat or something, in the sunken garden?"
Stevie nodded.
"So that," Hayes said. "Do that. Write something with the tunnel and something about the ransom in the sunken garden. We can do that. This is going to be great."
Minutes later, he was gone, and Stevie wondered how you made a script. It was a minor point. She was going into the tunnel. That was all that mattered. Strange Conversation 3 was instigated by Stevie. "Think about it," Stevie said, sitting in Nate's desk chair later that evening. "I could give you all the facts. There are transcripts. There are files. It's practically written. You'd barely need to do anything."
"I don't know anything about writing scripts,"
Nate said. "But you write."
"Scripts are totally different,"
Nate said.
"Scripts are... they're like an x-ray of a book, just the bones. The words people say and the things they do. Books are... everything. What the characters see and feel and how everything is told."
"It sounds easier," Stevie pointed out.
"It's a different thing," Nate said. "I'm supposed to show Dr. Quinn outlines for the next 3 chapters of my book, plus all this reading."
"Maybe," Stevie said, "if you wrote this, Dr. Quinn would let you have more time on the book. You could write this instead of that for a while. They love group projects here." Much like Stevie had been lured in by the tunnel, Nate could not resist the offer of skipping out on his book.
So I take this stuff and make it into some scripts, he said. And you do what?
I advise on technical matters.
Meaning?
I explain what happened, she said. I help you. We could call it truly devious. Nate exhaled long through his nose.
Fine,
he said.
Anything is better than doing what I'm supposed to be doing.
April 14, 1936, 3 p.m. Robert McKenzie was supervising the delivery of large sums of cash from New York. $200,000 was piled on the floor throughout the day. As he and George Marsh sorted the money, Ellingham removed two small bottles from a cabinet, along with a fine brush.
What's that?
Marsh asked.
A solution that Nair brewed up that we use for our games, Ellingham said. It dries completely clear. To see it, you need to use a solution and a special light. This stuff is so good that I've often suggested to Nair that he sell it to the government. If for some reason things don't go as they should tonight, I want to be able to track these bills.
The bills were marked down the side with a slash of the paint. Ellingham took the further measure of marking the bundle wrappers with his fingerprint. Fans were placed around the room to dry everything quickly, and then the money was packed into four bags.
I got some people out watching street corners tonight, Marsh said. Didn't tell them why or what for. Just to mark down license plates and anything unusual. I gave them 50 cents each if they give me good info. Give them $5 each, Ellingham said. Give them whatever they want. For $5, Marsh replied. They'll know this is big, and they might start coming up with stories. 50 cents keeps them honest and the profile low.
Robert McKenzie watched this all nervously. The call with instructions came at 7:07 that evening. The instructions said to move the money into Burlington and wait by a selected telephone booth for a call. Ellingham himself drove the car, with Robert McKenzie and George Marsh riding along. Each man brought a revolver. They arrived just before 8 p.m. when the phone rang. From there, they were instructed to drive toward Rock Point. Rock Point is very much what it sounds like, a rocky point off the side of Burlington, jutting into Lake Champlain. The point was largely uninhabited and the terrain rough. Once they arrived, they found an arrow chalked on the ground, pointing to the narrow dirt and rock path toward the water.
Robert,
Ellingham said,
you stay here with the car.
Robert looked at the pitch-black path into the rocky wooded point.
Mr. Ellingham, this is... You heard me, Robert. Stay here. If you see or hear nothing from us in an hour, turn around and drive back into town and get help.
Ellingham switched on his flashlight. His shoes slipped a bit against the slick rocks as he began the walk into the dark.
There's a light ahead,
he said. The path was marked by a series of impromptu lanterns made out of tin cans that would later be traced back to a diner in town. The diner appeared to have nothing to do with the crime. They had simply put out their garbage the night before. The garbage men on their route reported that their trash was empty in the morning. Someone had stolen the garbage. Even with the tiny tin can lights, the path was treacherous and blind, and it got more so as the lights spread out and led to the cliff face. Finally, at one rocky ledge, they found three cans and a coiled rope. Below, a lantern flashed.
There's a boat down there,
Marsh said, looking over carefully, his gun ready.
Use the rope,
called up a voice.
Lower the money.
Not until you show us Mrs. Ellingham and Alice,
Marsh called back.
Look next to you.
Ellingham scrabbled around and called for his wife, but found on the ground a handbag and a child's shoe.
We need a better sign,
Marsh said.
Proof of life.
Ellingham dropped his bag to the ground and tied the end of the rope to the handles. Marsh sighed and helped him secure it.
I'm putting the money on the rope,
Ellingham yelled.
Please, get my wife and child to a safe place so we can collect them. We have no interest in you, only them.
The money went over the rock face, all four bags of it. Ellingham tossed the rope end over the side.
That's everything,
Ellingham yelled. Below, the lantern began to flicker in a strange pattern.
What are they doing?
Ellingham said.
What is that? It's not Morse. I have no idea,
Marsh said, cocking his revolver.
Don't shoot at that boat! They could be in there!
The lantern went out. For a solid minute, there was no sound but the gentle lapping of the water and the wind.
What's happening?
Ellingham asked. For the first time that night, he sounded truly vulnerable and afraid.
I don't know,
Marsh said.
Hello!
Ellingham yelled.
I gave you the money! What now? Where are they?
The tiny boat sailed into oblivion, along with any chance of recovering Iris or Alice. 12. The process of writing Truly Devious, the video series, was not as smooth as Stevie had promised. On the first day, Nate greeted Stevie in the morning with a huge smile.
I drafted 2 chapters of the new book last night, he said. I mean, they're drafts. I was writing so fast, Stevie. I swear to you, I wrote like 15,000 words last night.
Is that good? She asked.
I don't know, he said. But it turns out that making me write this screenplay made me want to write anything else, which meant I worked on my book.
Wait, Stevie said. Wait, does that mean you didn't write the script? Nate shook his head happily.
Yep,
he said. By dinner, the story had changed.
Everything I wrote last night is terrible, he said. And we have no script. Let's write this thing. Show me that stuff again.
This pattern repeated several times. Stevie would produce copied transcripts of the police interviews. These were all readily available online. Nate would go off to write. Nate would do something else. Finally, Stevie sat down with Nate at the farm table for 5 hours, and side by side, passing the computer back and forth, they assembled 10 pages of script. The scene opened in the tunnel, with Hayes reading the Truly Devious letter. Then it went to the scene of the ransom drop, with Hayes playing Albert Ellingham. How Hayes was going to play Albert Ellingham, a man 30 years his senior, was not their problem. Nor was the fact that this scene involved Albert Ellingham rowing a boat across a lake that was no longer there. What mattered was that it all took place in the sunken garden. Because maybe if they shot there, Stevie could get into the observatory. Priorities. All in all, she was pleased with what they had done. The result looked script-like, with people saying words and doing things. On Monday evening, as it thundered outside, Stevie and Nate presented the script to a small team who assembled in the art barn. Along with her and Nate, there was Maris, who looked every inch the vixen in a tight, black, fuzzy sweater that was far too heavy for the weather. Her lips were a luminous poppy red. She had on semi-sheer black stockings with a seam running up the back, which she showed off by stretching her legs along the floor and rotating her feet, exposing her calves. She had a mug of smoky tea. Its steam perfumed the space.
I think you guys know Maris, Hayes said. She's going to help with the filming and direction.
There was also someone Stevie had seen before, in the yurt that first night. His face was long, with a high forehead and a lantern jaw and premature worry wrinkles in his forehead. He wore a long black coat and a scarlet scarf swung over his shoulders.
This is Dash,
Hayes said.
He's going to be our stage manager. Dash is the best.
Hayes read out the script from his computer, with Maris filling in the set directions. It was rough in spots, and most of it was just verbatim from the various case documents, but Nate had given it enough of a shape. Stevie had chosen the best parts of the transcripts, and to his credit, Hayes did a good job of playing Albert Ellingham. Somehow, they had actually made something that felt like a show.
This is amazing,
Hayes said as he finished.
Hey, Maris, would you take a few pictures just to document the working process?
Sure, she said, pulling out her phone and taking a few photos of Hayes studying his computer.
I need more detail, Dash said. What was it like that night?
It was foggy, Stevie said.
We can do fog, Dash said, pulling out his phone. You want fog? We can for sure do fog. Lots of fog,
Hayes said.
Oh, yeah.
Dash nodded,
I can rig a few T-90s all over the sunken garden. That chemical fog hangs low. We can make it look like the lake is full of fog.
Great,
Hayes said. Fog. I'm going to need fog machines, some poles to rig lights. We can make this work.
The next steps involved making it all work, and Stevie and Nate were not off the hook yet. There were costumes to assemble and props to prepare. For the costumes, Maris and Stevie went to the Ellingham Academy Theater. It was a small, dedicated space that looked like a tiny Greek temple from the outside. The theater space had a long, low stage, room for about 100 people, and black walls. The costume area was accessed by climbing a ladder in the corner of the lobby, which led to an attic that was composed of two long rooms separated by a hallway only 2 feet wide. The costume closet was on one side, with a sharply sloped roof Stevie kept hitting her head on. It was crammed completely with clothes racks, overstuffed with random clothing items that seemed to be loosely grouped by type. There was a rack thickly packed with men's suiting of all kinds, a rack of coats, a rack of dresses from every era, racks of fuzzy things, plaster and plastic armor, amorphous items that probably made sense in some context, like a giant foam French fry container and a brown sack covered in felt eyeballs. The floor was a sea of shoes and boots, and the racks above were hats, helmets, purses, shields, feathers. Just feathers? Just feathers. Why? And items of no known nature or provenance. The whole thing smelled like a thrift shop that had been baked in a low oven and felt like a too tight and too long hug by a rejected Muppet. Eventually, two suits were chosen, along with a hat and an overcoat. The prop closet, which was just as oppressive and even more loosely organized, produced a canvas bag and an oar for the fake boat. Wednesday evening brought something unexpected. Construction. The group gathered in the workshop, a barn structure off to the side of the maintenance area. It was open and cold and contained things that didn't feature much in Stevie's daily life. Tables with circular saws, racks of tools, large industrial bins. This was where the students of Ellingham came to make things that required space and tools and fire. This didn't include too many people. But it did include Janelle, who had a welding mask over her face and was staring down two pieces of metal. She lifted the mask as Stevie came in and waved.
I need you to cut these into lengths, Dash said to Stevie, pointing at some wood. Here are all the measurements.
He shoved a piece of paper at Stevie. She looked blankly at a bunch of numbers.
What?
She said.
Cut the wood into lengths.
Dash pointed at the wood, then the circular saw.
You must be kidding, Stevie said.
I'll do it, Maris said, her voice thick with a can-you-believe-this-one-doesn't-even-use-a-circular-saw vibe.
She sauntered up to the saw in her fuzzy sweater and leaned over expertly. The buzz saw cranked to life, and Maris put a board on it and sliced it in two, the air filled with the scent of sawdust. Hayes came sauntering in while all of this work was going on, greeted everyone, and rested on the ground and studied his script.
Hey!
Janelle said as Dash scooped up some poles from an upright storage container in the corner.
What are you doing with those? Making light rigs,
Dash said.
Oh, no, you are not. Those are my poles. You can't need all these poles, Dash said.
I do, Janelle said.
We just need them for a few days.
My poles are specially measured for my machine. These aren't just any poles, Janelle said.
Look, there is no way you need all these poles. I'm taking some.
Could we borrow a few? Stevie said quietly. I'll make sure you get them back.
For you, Janelle said. I would only give my poles to you.
Dash had the poles out of the bucket in a shot and hurried them out of the workshop. Maris had stopped sawing for a bit and was looking in a large blue industrial bin on the side of the room.
There's dry ice here, she called to Dash. Lots of it.
I have enough fog machines, he said. The liquid is easier to work with.
Maris shrugged and shut the container. After constructing their ramps and organizing their poles and all the things that would be needed to film in the sunken garden on Saturday, the plan was made for the excursion into the tunnel. It would be the next night, with everyone meeting behind the art barn at 7. Still smelling of sawdust, Stevie walked home and dropped into bed. For a few minutes, she rested on her back, fully dressed, and felt the cool air from the window brush against her face. The late summer twilight fell into darkness. There were footsteps creaking above her. David was home. She could tell everyone in her house by their footsteps. She started to understand how Minerva settled and shifted almost musically. She reached up and felt the cool iron of the bedstead. She pulled her comforter over her, sealing herself in with the sawdust smell coming off her sweatpants. Janelle was behind one wall, Ellie the other. She was in the middle, and it felt utterly normal. The thought grabbed her. She had settled in. This was home, and she had almost completed a major project about the Ellingham case with her friends. Well, Nate was her friend, and probably Hayes and Maris and Dash. Her friend Janelle gave her the supplies. A pleasant wave of satisfaction swept over her, and it inspired her to lean over and grab her phone from the bedside stand. She had a note app on her phone that had carefully organized files of images and information about the Ellingham case. She clicked open the folder marked Social. This was her research on the life the Ellinghams had led here before the tragedy, back when the house was just a weird and wonderful mountain showpiece, and famous friends would come to ski in the winter, watch the leaves in the fall, and drink all the time. Some of those people probably stayed in this building, in this room, back before the school was opened and Minerva was a guest house. Stevie flipped through, stopping on one of her favorites, an image of a guest list from a party in 1929. She had no idea who these people were, but she loved reading the names. Gus Swenson, the Billbody twins, Esther Neal and Buck Randolph, the Davis sisters, Greta and Flo, Bernard Hendish, Lady Isabella D'Isla, Dr. Frank Dodds, Frankie Sullivan, the Van Warners, Telegraph McMurray, and Lorna Darvish. The list went on and on. They had come to have their champagne here, to dance under the stars. Actors, writers, artists, socialites. And then Dottie Epstein lived here. Stevie had read about Dottie, one of the brightest in her school, strong-willed, brilliant, a tough Lower East Side girl who could steal apples and quote Virgil. Stevie reached down for her phone to look at Dottie's picture for perhaps the thousandth time. She had a head of brown curls, apple cheeks, and a gap between her front teeth. She was the often forgotten victim because she was not rich. She did not own a school. She was just a smart girl trying to make something of herself at Ellingham Academy. She read mysteries. She had gone to the observatory to read, leaving a book behind. Stevie set her phone on her stomach and stared up at the ceiling for a long time. The case needed solving for all of them, but maybe Dottie most of all. Dottie, who loved mysteries. Tomorrow night, she would go into the tunnel that had been blocked since 1938. Truly, this was something no one else who looked into the case in recent decades had done. She was literally going to be on new ground. Dottie had passed through that tunnel. She had died in or near or because of it. The tunnel marked the place where Dottie crossed over from life to death. Stevie fell asleep in this position, phone on her stomach, thinking about Dottie and the tunnel. A pulse of light brought her back to consciousness. Stevie blinked, confused. Her brain tried to work out the source of the light for a split second. Car headlights? No. Still mostly asleep, she pushed herself up on one arm. The light, or something made of light, was on the wall. It filled the space next to the fireplace. Blobs of color, letters, words. It was all a scramble in her brain until she realized the blobs were a message made of cut-out letters. Riddle, riddle, on the wall. Murder comes to pay a call. A body in a lonely field. Will its secrets be revealed? Or the lady in the lake? Will she give the lucky break? Alice, Alice, where are you? Won't you give a single clue? The detective's here. It's time to play. Truly devious lives another day. In another flash, the message was gone.
13. Stevie was out of bed in a second, dropping roughly to the floor. Her eyes were throbbing slightly, reacting to the sudden wakefulness, the shift from dark to light. The words were tumbling in her head as she crawled to the window. When she reached it, she huddled beneath it for a moment, her body shaking from the adrenaline. Was there someone there? Would she pop up and be face to face? The window was open about 6 inches. Would someone reach in? Only one way to find out. She pushed herself to her knees with one quick movement. Outside was dark and still. She clutched the window, unsure whether or not to slam it down or open it farther to look out. Her grip on the frame tightened. Another idea. She pulled her heaviest book on criminology from the shelf, the one she had scored at a library sale for $3, the one that was her prized possession. She stuck it out the window and let it drop. No one screamed. She heard the book land in the grass with a thud. She slid over to the closet and pulled out the tactical flashlight that the school had provided and switched it on and scanned the area. Nothing. Just darkness and more darkness, and the slight rustling sounds of the night. She closed and locked the window, pulled the curtains, and tucked her head into her knees. What had it said? Riddle, riddle, on the wall, murder, something, something, something. And then it hit. Panic attacks are mean little freaks. First came the speed, then came clamping in the throat, the lightness in her head, the feeling of blind acceleration into confusion. Then comes the strange wind that blew into her mind, knocking everything over and turning everything into a mockery of reality. Every avenue was blocked off. Every option meant doom. Nothing made any sense. It felt like hands were around her neck. Stevie gulped hard, proving to herself that she could swallow, that her airway was open. "It's fine," she said to herself. "Breathe, one, two." But she couldn't breathe, one, two, because the universe was converging to a point. It would be a welcome feeling to pass out, except there was a terror that somehow the merry-go-round would just go on, even in an unconscious state. People say depression lies. Anxiety is just stupid. It's unable to tell the difference between things that are actually scary, being buried alive, for example, and things that are not scary at all, being in bed under the covers. It hits all the same buttons. Stop, go, up, down. It's all the same to anxiety. The curtains said fear, and the floor said fear. The dark said fear, and if she turned the light on, that too would likely say fear. She turned the light on anyway. The faces of the murdered Ellinghams looked at her accusingly from the caseboard. She hurried over to the dresser, pulling open the drawer with shaking hands. She knocked out one Ativan, then hurried back over to her nightstand and washed it down with a gulp of water from the bottle next to her bed. It would take some time to work, and the universe was still howling in her ears. She needed help. She slipped into the hallway, bumping against the doorframe as she went. She went to Janelle's door and knocked. After a moment, there was a sleepy,
"Yeah?"
Stevie tried the door and found it was unlocked. She was too muddled to be embarrassed or feel bad for waking her.
"What?"
Janelle said, sitting up.
"Are you okay?"
"Panic attack," Stevie said. Can you?"
Janelle pushed herself out of bed, grabbed her robe, and put it over Stevie's shoulders. She guided Stevie to the bed and sat her down, putting an arm around her shoulders.
"Sorry,"
Stevie wheezed.
"Sorry."
"Here," Janelle said, taking her hand. "It's okay. We're going to do this. Hold my hand." Holding Janelle's hand brought some semblance of reality back.
"Can I sit here for a minute?" Stevie said.
"You stay until it's over," Janelle said. "As long as it takes. Did something happen?" Stevie couldn't bring herself to explain. Everything was wobbling. She leaned back against Janelle and the wall behind the bed and waited for everything to stop moving, for the words to stop running through her mind, for truly devious to leave. The next morning, when Stevie emerged from her room, Janelle was in the common room, looking amazingly perky for someone who had been up half the night helping a friend. She was wearing a fleecy sweatshirt that said, "Ask me about my cat," and a pair of yoga pants, and her braids were coiled up under a cheerful red scarf.
Stevie, on the other hand, was still wearing the sawdust-covered sweatpants. She had not consulted her hair. It could be doing anything. She had not bothered to wipe her face or crusty eyes or brush her teeth. She just needed to get up and shake off the night. Stevie was embarrassed looking at her friend. She'd never really had an experience like that before, outside of her parents, where someone actually took care of you like that. Janelle had put her back into bed just before dawn, and Stevie had slept heavily for a few hours. Now she was groggy and heavy and slow.
How are you doing?
Janelle asked in a low voice.
I'm okay, Stevie said, a little nauseous. Tired, but okay.
She couldn't bring herself to say thanks to you out loud, but she tried to convey it in her eyes, and then by generally being awkward. Janelle just shook her head in a don't worry about it kind of way. Stevie went outside. The morning was fresh and bright. Big blue skies and shaggy, happy clouds blowing over the mountains. It was the kind of morning that mocked the fear of the night before. This kind of pleasantness almost made it worse. How could she be anxious when everything was so cheerful? Very easily, as it happens, brain chemistry doesn't care about how pretty things are. She stepped along the edge of Minerva, through the moist grass to retrieve her book from the ground outside her window. It was a bit damp, but on examination it showed no real damage. What had happened? She had been reading case materials right up until the time she went to sleep. She was thinking about the kidnapping and the tunnel. She could have easily dreamed that note on the wall. But it was vivid, crisp. She had gotten out of bed. She'd thrown a book out her window trying to catch a stranger. She watched the sky for a moment and held her wet book and tried to work out what was real. Then she rubbed her burning, tired eyes. She still had to go to class. She dried the cover with her shirt and brought it back inside. As she went to her room, she bumped into David coming downstairs. It was nothing, really. He just kind of half-smiled at her. He had that long mouth with the twisting edges, just a smile. But something about it made Stevie boil. She blocked him. Good night, she asked.
It's so nice of you to ask, he replied, leaning against the wall. Sure. How about you?
His tone was neutral, but his smile was expanding by just a few millimeters. Busy last night? She asked.
You have a lot of questions.
Still neutral. Still half-smiling. Something in his eyes, though. A flash. It was impossible to tell what was going on, but there was something there.
This is fun and all,
he said.
But can I go and get breakfast?
Stevie stepped aside, but turned to watch him go. Could David have put that note on her wall? She was fairly unfocused during the discussion of leaves of grass that morning. She spent most of the discussion trying to remember the words she had seen. Riddle, riddle. Something murder, something lake, something Alice. Definitely truly devious in there somewhere. But the more she tried to remember, the more the words slipped away and didn't feel like words at all. Walt Whitman was getting involved now. And the hints about old men and mothers, and the offspring taken soon out of their laps. What do you think has become of the young and old men? And what do you think has become of the women and children? They are alive and well somewhere. Riddle, riddle. A woman in a lake, a girl in a hole. She would be a girl in a hole later tonight when she went into the tunnel. She went in and out of the explanation of the functions of the axial and the appendicular skeleton in anatomy. Lunch brought her closer to the surface. And by the time she was in Spanish lab, the dread was burning away and she began to focus on going into the tunnel. She felt a flutter of excitement, which carried her through the afternoon. Stevie hurried back to Minerva in the mid-afternoon to get her flashlight and gloves, then met Janelle for their first yoga class at 5. Yoga was the class she picked from Ellingham's mandatory physical education selection. It sounded better than running for fitness and clarity, cooperative boot camp, or perspectives on movement. At Stevie's high school, they let you just go on the treadmill for half an hour and left you alone to listen to podcasts, which was literally the only thing she preferred about her old high school. Janelle met her outside the art barn, a rolled mat tucked under her arm.
Doing okay? Janelle asked.
Yeah, Stevie said. I think so.
Anxiety dreams are the worst, she said.
Stevie had, late last night, managed to explain to Janelle what she had seen. She must have made it sound like it was definitely a dream, and not some questionable occurrence that may or may not have been real.
I guess I dreamed it, Stevie said. I don't know.
Janelle nodded, as if this was the only answer she had been expecting.
But, Stevie said as they walked into the art barn, let's just say for a second I didn't dream it. How hard is it to project something on the wall like that?
I guess you'd need a projector.
Oh, that's easy, Janelle said. You can make one out of cardboard and tape and a mirror. It's not impossible, but...
I mean, Stevie said, I woke up. I was in bed and I saw it on the wall. I threw my book out the window trying to catch whoever was out there, like, tried to drop the book on their head.
Did you catch anyone? Janelle said.
See anyone?
No.
If you're woken up in certain phases of sleep, reality and dreams, they blend together for a little bit. And being up here for the first time, it's probably going to cause some anxiety dreams. My anxiety dreams are all about how I just never go to class, and it's the end of the year, and I've skipped everything. On a good night, I dream about advances in 3D printing and Gina Torres dressed as Wonder Woman. But here's the thing. She stopped Stevie before they entered the yoga room.
I think we all come here because we have something in our heads we can't get out, Janelle said.
We're all kind of fixated on something. I want to make machines, and you want to solve mysteries, and Nate wants to write, or he doesn't want to write, and Ellie wants to live in her own art commune.
Hayes, he makes shows. I guess David makes games. I see him doing coding, so I know he can. We're all kind of in our own world.
It's that your world is a real place here. I think your brain is a little busy processing the information. You had an intense dream. Something woke you. You can carry through some of those states and see things and think you're awake and not really be completely out of a sleep state. Sleep is a funny thing. But like that, everything seemed to make sense.
How are you so smart? Stevie asked.
I read a lot, Janelle said, smiling. She unzipped the front of her bag, shoved her pass inside and secured the lanyard to a clip, and zipped the bag back up again. Janelle did everything completely, even putting her pass away.
And I'm just amazing.
The class was in a small studio room. Everyone dropped their bags in the hall and crowded inside. Yoga was popular, and the mats were only inches apart. Stevie used one from the school supply. It was rubbery and purple and smelled a bit like bleach and feet. The teacher, Daria, had a little accordion piano thing she played as she made everyone sit on some blankets at the start of class with their eyes closed. They were supposed to be focusing on their breath, but Stevie kept going back to that flickering moment where she had jerked out of sleep the night before and read the words on the wall. She played it back again and again. How awake had she been when her feet hit the floor, when she tried to memorize the words? It was impossible to know. Sleep had its own mysteries, and Daria was telling them to get into downward facing dog. Stevie was still new at this yoga thing, and Daria was soon standing over her and arranging her hands and hips and feet. Stevie had watched a few videos to prepare for this before coming. But in the moment, she was completely lost, and whatever move she made was somehow wrong. She was two moves behind at all times, at best. Her knee was in the wrong spot, her arm not high enough, her twist not twisty. Daria hovered and, in a sweet, whispery voice, adjusted her positions again and again, and eventually planted herself by Stevie as she guided the class. How did everyone else know how to do yoga? The one advantage to all of this was that it cleared Stevie's mind of everything else. She heard exercise did that. Was this what they meant? You were so busy being confused and trying to stop your sweaty hands from slipping on a mat that you couldn't think anymore? Stevie did approve of the fact that yoga ended by lying on the floor in corpse pose.
You're doing your filming thing tonight, right? Janelle said at the end of a class as they went out into the hall to retrieve their things. Because Vi and I are going to...
She was fishing hard in her bag, poking her hand into the bottom and the pockets.
My pass, she said. It's gone. I zipped it up. You saw me.
I did, Stevie said. Are you sure it's not there?
Janelle yanked the front pouch open.
No pass.
How the hell did it get lost? Janelle said. Did someone take it?
I need to find it. I get access to things, and if I lose that...
We'll look, Stevie said, already on the floor, digging around in the pile of other bags as people came out of class and took them away.
They charge you $150 for a new one, Janelle said. Crap.
Crap.
It's okay, Stevie assured her. Someone must have just screwed up.
How?
By going into my bag and taking it?
I have to tell Pix. Who steals passes? Who went into my bag?
Janelle was getting upset now. This kind of disorder agitated her, and she definitely had put her pass into her bag.
Maybe it was a prank? To steal my pass?
Stevie almost said.
Or put a letter on my wall? But since the jury was out on whether or not that was real, she refrained. It was another weird occurrence in a short amount of time. A letter and a key. It had the feeling of a strange game, and one that filled Stevie with a low, simmering worry. Games are not fun when you don't know you're playing. 14. It was a perfect night to go underground. Autumn was different up here, Stevie noted, as she and Nate made their way down the path to the art barn at 8 o'clock that night. It was more wild. This was probably to be expected, but still, the experience caught her by surprise. There was more scurrying in the bushes, more drama in the dark treetops, more wind. The air was thick with the fecund smell of early dropping leaves and the fragrant decay of layers of undergrowth. Everything was alive or vocal in its demise. This smell, this feeling. This is why Albert Ellingham had insisted on the spot.
My kingdom for a Starbucks or something, Nate said. Are you feeling like we've been here forever, too? When do we start eating each other or fighting for the conch?
Stevie and Nate were both wearing dark clothes for this night mission. Nate was wearing baggy dark jeans and a slouchy black sweater that hung down to his fingers, making his long arms even longer. He looked about as excited as he normally did, but Stevie was used to this now. Nate was a rain cloud, but he was her friendly rain cloud, and the world needs some rain. Stevie was fully prepared for the venture with some black cargo pants and her black hoodie. Her wardrobe had not let her down. Both had the school-issued tactical flashlights in their bags.
So this tunnel,
Nate said as they rounded the path by the whispering statue heads.
What was it?
A supply tunnel for alcohol during Prohibition, Stevie said. They used to have trucks come down from Canada. They kept the booze under the observatory in case of a raid. Not that anyone would have raided Albert Ellingham.
I mean the tunnel, Nate said. Something about it being open again?
Because it was filled up for a while, Stevie said vaguely. She didn't want to say, since 1938, just unearthed, who even knows what's down there now?
And we're allowed?
No one said not to, Stevie replied.
But also we're not supposed to tell anyone.
Act first, apologize later. She felt Nate staring at her, but she turned the other way to look at one of the grimacing statue heads.
I don't know if this is really going to count for 3 chapters,
Nate said, digging his hands into his pockets.
We've only been doing this for a week.
What did Dr. Quinn say?
That she would consider it when she saw it. But she looks like she considers broken bottles to be part of your complete breakfast.
I think you worry too much, Stevie said.
Of course I worry too much,
Nate said.
But I'm usually right. The people who worry are always right. That's how it works.
Stevie decided not to contradict him on that one. Hayes, Maris, and Dash were already waiting by the far wing of the art barn, where the construction equipment and the dumpsters were, out by the maintenance road. They were also dressed in black, Hayes in something form-fitting, Dash in something artistically loose and flowing, and Maris in dark leggings and an oversized fuzzy sweater with a tight black hat on her head. She even wore a musky, smoky perfume to match the occasion.
Okay,
Hayes said, switching on his flashlight.
Let's go.
They entered the woods, the ring of true wilderness that enveloped Ellingham Academy, the place where the trees were not orderly and no statues bloomed. At least, they entered the bit of it by the maintenance road. Stevie had a good sense of where the tunnel ran and where the opening should be, but the opening was going to be flush with the ground. Hayes seemed to have a very clear sense of where he was going.
How did you find this? Maris asked.
The tunneling is the best part,
Hayes said with a smile.
This one opened in the spring. They didn't want anyone to know.
But you knew?
I saw,
he said, grinning and shining his flashlight under his chin. He led them about 30 yards from the road into a tight cluster of trees. Then he stopped and started stomping at the ground. There was the heavy thunk of thick metal.
Light,
he said. Maris shone a flashlight down as he scraped off an inch or so of loose dirt.
They covered it up,
he said, bending down.
And it looks like they put a lock on it. It wasn't locked before. That's going to be a problem.
Let me see, Stevie said, kneeling on the ground beside him. The ground was spongy and cold beneath her knees. Just a standard padlock, she said, peering at the end. Can you shine a light? Maris shone her flashlight down on the lock. Stevie went into her bag and fished around for a while until she found two paper clips at the bottom. She straightened them and inserted them into the lock. One she used as a tension wrench, and with the other she manipulated the pins. It was all about slow, careful movement, feeling every millimeter. Locks are tiny, and their pins are tinier still, and the movement needed to lift one is barely a flinch. Luckily, she had picked padlocks like this many times. It was a good, cheap hobby to practice while watching mysteries, and it seemed like the kind of skill she should have. It popped open.
Whoa,
Hayes said.
How the hell did you learn to do that?
Stevie simply smiled, got up, and dusted off her hands.
Nice one, Maris added approvingly.
Finally, there was something Stevie could do that Maris could not. Dash was texting, and Nate stood in stunned silence. Hayes pulled open the doors, revealing a pitch-black hole in the ground. Stevie shone her flashlight down on a dozen or so bare concrete steps, leading into more darkness.
That's not ominous-looking at all, Nate said.
Stevie made her way to the front and squatted down, shining her light into the hole. The space in front of her was a violent, velvety dark. Anything could have been there. A million spiders. Someone with a knife. Or worse, just a lot of dark tunnel. She counted the steps and felt around with her foot to assure herself she had reached the last one, before shining her light up. The million spiders, if present, were well hidden. And there was no one with a knife. The tunnel was made of brick and concrete and was in fairly good condition, aside from a few upsetting jags and cracks that were probably caused by years of snow and ice. There was an overwhelming smell of earth and age and stagnant air. The tunnel felt tighter than she thought it would be, snugly fitting two people across. It made sense, of course. It's not easy to build a secret underground tunnel. You needed it to be just big enough to get your boxes of booze or sneak around with your friends while playing one of the Ellingham's famous games. The brick made it feel like they were inside a horizontal chimney. Stevie got lightheaded for a moment and ran her hand over the walls. They almost felt wet, and she traced the patterns of the mortar with her fingers. This was history, real history, opening up for her. It was almost too much to take in. She ignored the effort going on around her as Dash pulled a tripod out of his bag and opened it up. And Maris and Hayes tipped their heads together to read the truly devious letter off his phone and work out where to stand. Nate slid up alongside Stevie and broke into her reverie.
Why do you know how to pick locks?
He asked. Because there are a lot of tutorials online.
That's how, he said. Why?
Who doesn't want to know how to pick a lock? It only took a few hours. Buy a lock for $5.
Still not why.
Because they do it on TV, Stevie finally said. It seems like a good thing to know. I like detectives, okay? We all have our hobbies.
Remind me not to get on your bad side, Nate said.
Stevie stared into the dark. She shone her light into it, but there was no end in sight, just more dark.
Are they sure about the structural integrity? Nate asked. Should we really be in here? It feels like an elevator shaft on the Titanic.
It's fine, Stevie said, because it probably was. Most things are. Stevie swept her light around, steering it away from a terrifying crack in the side, and then aimed it squarely forward. I'm going to the end, she said.
Seriously?
Nate said. This is what I came here for. My dragons are down there.
Stevie, I wouldn't.
You're not me, Stevie said. If I die, avenge me. She was joking, but not totally. She had to go, and it also felt like a possible mistake. Some mistakes you have to make. The distance, she knew, was about 400 feet. 400 feet of dark tunnel may not sound like a lot of dark tunnel, but it is, in fact, a lot of dark tunnel. But she was going in, like people who crawled into pockets of pyramids sealed for thousands of years with no idea what was ahead of them went in. There were buried mysteries, and sometimes you must go into the earth. She wondered if she would panic. To her surprise, though, her heartbeat was slow, steady as she took each step into the velvety nothingness of the tunnel. Soon there would be a door at the end. She reached her arm out in front of her to find it, and eventually she felt the heavy wood at her fingertips. Her heart literally skipped a beat and sent a glug of confused blood popping. The door was made of thick pieces of wood belted together with iron, that small, sliding window looking like something from a medieval jail. There was no knob on this door, no lock. Originally, this door would have been opened from the other side, so if it was locked on that side, that was the end of her exploring. She pushed. It opened. She was going farther. She was going in. This was like a dream. The room beyond was small. Three sides of the space were composed of shelving. This had been the liquor room. The deliveries would come in through the tunnel, then come into this room for storage. A metal ladder went up to a hatch in the ceiling. Stevie tested it for a moment with a shake. It seemed to be firmly secured to the wall and in perfect repair. Could she do this? Could she actually go to the place where it happened? The others were nowhere behind her. She was doing this alone. She tested the ladder again, then tucked her flashlight into her bag. She was going up into the dark. She proceeded slowly, trusting in the ladder and knowing that at some point her head would make contact with the hatch above. She would use that sensation as a guide. Up, up, up into the dark, moving more slowly as she went. She felt the hatch against her hair, against her scalp. She backed down a rung and reached up to test it. It didn't give at first, but she pressed harder. There was an unholy squawk as the ancient springs were forced back into action, but the hatch popped open. Some people want to go to see the Eiffel Tower or Big Ben. Some people dream of their proms or their someday weddings. Some people dream of going up in a hot air balloon or scuba diving in clear Caribbean waters. Everyone has a dream place, and Stevie Bell was climbing into hers. The domed observatory seemed smaller now that she was inside of it. The thick glass triangles that composed most of the structure were encrusted with dirt, so all was dark. She shone her light around the stone floor, the bench that ran around the side. There was nothing in here now but some dead leaves and dirt. It smelled like a shed. Dottie had been here. This is where they found her Sherlock Holmes book. Albert Ellingham had come right through that stout door. He'd been struck and fallen to the floor. Here? On this spot? Had the money been counted here? Was this where it all started to go so very wrong? She closed her eyes for a moment. Maybe, if she breathed this air and felt this space, maybe she could go back.
Hey!
Dash's voice cut through the silence as he yelled from below.
Come on, we need you.
The moment was over. The filming was very quick. All that was needed was for Hayes to recite the truly devious letter while walking down the tunnel length. He and Maris passed the camera back and forth to get some long shots, but it was dark and cold and hard to film, and time was not on their side. At 8:30, they all crept back to the steps. A quick look outside showed that no one was waiting for them to pop out of the hole. The doors were closed.
"We can't all go together,"
Hayes said, holding the padlock in his hand.
"If anyone sees us all coming from this direction, they might realize we were down here. Nate, Stevie, you guys go first. Dash, you should go the other way around. Maris, we can go last."
As Stevie and Nate walked back through the dark, Nate glanced over his shoulder.
"I think they're going to go back and bone in that tunnel,"
he said. "Bone," Stevie repeated. "Did you have to say bone?"
"Tunnel boner,"
Nate said.
"A new fragrance for men."
"They wouldn't," Stevie said. "They won't."
"Why not?"
"Because that's the tunnel. You don't just tunnel bone in that tunnel."
"Sometimes a tunnel is just a tunnel,"
Nate said. Stevie ground her jaw a bit and walked on, her hands deep in her hoodie pockets. The magic of the tunnel and the observatory was still on her, and she wanted to hold it as long as possible. She thought of the letter that she had seen on her wall. It really had been so vivid. Dreams had a way of blurring and fading the moment they were over. The edges were sharp on this, the colors bright. Her mind had taken a screenshot. Had it been real? It was possible. Most things are possible. It wasn't likely, though. What was likely was that her anxious and excited brain, full of new stimuli, conjured up something bright and shiny for her. Something so magical and odd that it stamped its impression on her brain cells for a little longer than normal. Thinking about it logically, who knew or cared enough about her to go to those kinds of lengths, and to what end? It had been a dream. Just as Janelle said, Janelle made sense. Still, the feeling was there, and it felt like Truly Devious was calling out from the past. Truly Devious, the known ghoul, the laughing murderer. But some things don't stay buried. Not tunnels, not secrets. Truly Devious was not immune. Who is Truly Devious, 80 years on? PostDetective.com. April 13, 2016. On April 8, 1936, a letter arrived at the Burlington, Vermont office of Albert Ellingham. Albert Ellingham was, at the time, one of the richest men in America. He constructed an estate and a school in the mountains outside of Burlington, and it was there he lived with his wife and his daughter, breathing the sweet, clean air. A Burlington office collected his personal and business mail. And every day, a car would take sacks of correspondence from Burlington to the house, well up on Mount Hatchet, where it would be sorted and processed by his secretary. That day, in with the hundreds of letters, one stood out. The envelope was postmarked from Burlington. The address of the Ellingham estate was written on the front in dull pencil, in heavy, square strokes. Inside was a single piece of writing paper that contained the words, "Look, a riddle. Time for fun. Should we use a rope or gun? Knives are sharp and gleam so pretty. Poison's slow, which is a pity. Fire is festive. Drowning's slow. Hanging's a ropey way to go. A broken head, a nasty fall. A car colliding with a wall. Bombs make a very jolly noise. Such ways to punish naughty boys. What shall we use? We can't decide, just like you cannot run or hide. Ha ha, truly devious." Threats to Albert Ellingham and his family were not new. In fact, Albert Ellingham had barely survived a car bombing several years before. This was during a time in which industrialists were often under threat. What made this letter so different? For a start, it was constructed of colorful words and letters that would later be determined to come from popular magazines. In bright, cheerful print, it spelled out a diabolical poem, one that listed the many ways that Albert Ellingham might die. The letter writer gave themselves a name, Truly Devious. 5 days later, while out on a drive, Albert Ellingham's wife, Iris, was kidnapped along with their 3-year-old daughter, Alice. Along with Iris and Alice, a young girl named Dolores Epstein, who was a student at Ellingham's new academy on the site, also vanished. A ransom demand was called in that evening, giving Albert Ellingham just a few minutes to bundle up the money in his safe and take it to a lake on his property. Ellingham was a bit short of cash, so the kidnappers beat up the person sent to collect Iris and Alice and demanded more. Robert McKenzie, Ellingham's 30-year-old private secretary, begged to call the police. But Ellingham was convinced that doing so would put his family in more danger. Instead, along with family friend George Marsh by his side, Ellingham took $200,000 in marked bills to a remote point in Burlington and lowered the money down to a boat waiting below on Lake Champlain. The boat sailed off. On May 16, 1936,